On this episode, I'm going to be talking with Jarrett Forrester, singer, songwriter, author, business entrepreneur, and true road warrior. He does well over 200 shows a year, either solo or with his band, and he has so many other things going on. You're going to like this guy. Join me as we get to know Jarrett Forrester on this episode of Backstage with Chris Lee.
How you doing, man?
Good. Good. I just left the tattoo shop.
I saw your post on social media, man. That's pretty cool.
He started late, and I was like, I got to be out of here at 5:30.
So describe that to me. I'm looking at a turtle sitting on the stump playing a guitar. Is he smoking a cigar?
Smoking a cigar, yeah. That was a last-minute ad. I'm a big cigar guy. I love classic traditional tattoos.
Yeah.
And so the whole thing with classic tattoos is there's one that's pretty famous, and it's a frog playing a banjo.
Right.
Sitting on a stump. And I was like, I don't really like frogs. And so that's why I was like, can we do a turtle with a guitar? And he's like, hell yeah, we can.
I'm going to share this on the podcast page. Who did it?
Brett Wilbanks, he's at Blind Tiger Tattoo in the West Village. They've literally been open like 2 weeks.
Really?
And so I'm going back Wednesday to do another one. This will be the third one he's done on my
leg. Did he work on this today?
Literally, he put the Sanoderm on me 20 minutes before I got here.
And this is on your leg, right?
This is on my leg.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you to show it to me. I can see the picture. I'm good. And I looked. You're playing somewhere every day this coming week. Today was your day off?
Yeah, Monday. Once it warms up, pretty much from March, April to October is easily 20, 25 shows.
Let's start out. Where were you born?
I was born in Greenville. I'm born and raised here.
Yeah.
I've only lived in one other place my entire life, and that was in Florence. And I lived down there for a year and then came straight back.
Yeah. How old are you, man?
I'm 25.
Okay. And who are your parents?
My parents are Angel and Jeremy Forrester.
Okay.
And they're both born and raised here. Mom's from Simpsonville, dad's from Greer.
Okay.
So I mean, my lineage is all here.
and I haven't done any research on you, other than seeing stuff you post on social, and we've talked back and forth, and we've liked similar things. But I try to use the podcast to get to know the person.
Yeah,
we've never met.
I got really into just the songwriting aspect and the dissecting of stuff right before I started high school.
Right.
That's when I decided that I wanted to be a musician, was right literally like 2 weeks before I started high school.
And
I did choir and stuff.
Yeah.
But when it was like August, and it was 2012, and my uncle had introduced me to Will Hoag, who to this day is one of my heroes and somebody who I aspire to be like, from a writing standpoint. And he had just fired his drummer, and we was at the Grey Eagle in Asheville, and we sat there, and I watched him walk to the middle of the room. Have you been to the Grey Eagle in Asheville?
Yes.
It's a small room. Yeah. I think it only holds like 400
people.
Pretty
intimate place.
And he walked to the middle of the room, unplugged his guitar, and he filled that entire room.
Yeah.
And I was like, that right there is what I want to do. And through him, I found these other writers and just dove deep into just the dissecting and watched these people. And then through them, I found their heroes. I wasn't raised, like, so one of the main, like, B.J. Barnes, one of his biggest inspirations is Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
Well, I had never, I knew Born in the USA.
Sure.
But about 2 years ago, I did a complete deep dive into his entire catalog. And so that's how I found so many other people, because I'm like, this stuff is great. And I wasn't raised on it. And BJ even talks about it. He's like, your parents don't listen to deep cuts. You have to find the deep
Springsteen
cuts.
Is one hell of a storyteller, you know, and Glory Days, I think it's a great song. You're Born to Run, it's fine. I love stuff like 10th Avenue Freeze Out, there's another one. Oh, My Hometown, you know, just a killer song anyway. And I love Bruce, and he's a hell of a storyteller. I love songwriters, and I love the craft, and I watched the documentary of Dean Dillon about him, and it was Tennessee Whiskey. And,
yeah.
It was fascinating to me how some songs come just like that, and within minutes. And then some songs takes years to finish.
Exactly.
They'll write a verse or they'll have a melody and they'll just put it on the back burner. And then they'll hear something that's, okay, well, that might fit there. And then they may not write it themselves. They may just say, look, I've got this for a friend of theirs or another writing partner. And they go, got this. Well, the guy said, oh, I know what to go with that. I got something. And then they'll bring the two together.
Exactly. And that's what it's about is like, I love co-writing and the releases that we'll probably end up talking about later that I got coming out. One of them is a song that I wrote with my buddy, Chance Stanley,
okay.
who I'm going on the road with for a week, at the end of this month. And like, I needed songs. I got five songs coming out.
Yeah.
And I made the bright decision. I know what'll make me sit down and actually write songs. Because like you said, I stay busy. Like, I don't have, like, when I don't have to be on, I'm not on. And I'm just like, I just want to sit down. And so I was like, I'll just book the studio time. Then I'll figure out what songs. Well, it's like a month before I'm supposed to go into the studio, and Brad Phillips at 101 is texting me going, hey, man, can we get rough tracks of these songs? And I'm like, yeah, as soon as I figure out what songs I'm doing. And so I called Chance, and I'm like, dude, I'm like, I need some songs. I was like, I got to figure something out. I was like, send me whatever you have.
Book the time, and it's getting close.
Well, that's what I said. It was like a month before, and he goes, I got the. He said, here, I'm going to send you these. So he sent me like five songs. And so I go through, and I listen, and I love them all because Chance is such a great writer, and he's a different writer than me.
Yeah.
And that's what made, I try to write like this dark, you know, stuff, and Chance has this like, he's the kind of person you just look at and you're like, why are you so happy? It's 8 a.m. But he's such a great guy and such a great writer. And so he sent me these five songs that I couldn't pick.
Yeah.
So I showed him to my band. I was like, hey, I need y'all to pick one of these five songs. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, just pick one. I was like, because whatever one you pick, I'm going to finish writing. Because they were all mostly finished, but not completely finished. I was like, whichever one y'all pick, I'm going to finish writing. And then that's going on the single.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, and so they picked one that's called My Mind. And so I told Chance, I'm like, hey, I'm going to sit down and finish this song. I'll send it to you tomorrow. And I sat down, and worked on it for about an hour, and couldn't figure anything out. Got up, made a cup of coffee, came back, and went, I got it. Wrote out everything that needed to be finished, sent him a demo. He's like, sounds good to me. And then I sent that same demo to Brad. I was like, sound good? He's like, sounds great. I'm like, perfect. I'm like, don't ask questions. Just don't ask questions about it. But yeah, I mean, co-writing is one of my favorite things.
Yeah, but you talk about booking the studio time ahead of time, and now with the cost and everything, you've got to be ready to go when you get in the studio, because back in the day, these major bands would come off the road and they'd rent a studio for 2 months,
and
they would write you know, while on studio time. And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, that seemed like an incredible waste of money, you know, but they always got the inspiration. And that's just the way they did it. They'd get inspiration for a song, then they'd go in and try to start tracking it and cutting it, and they would just build it there in the studio instead of working on it at home or somewhere at a practice hall, and they would just do it on studio time. Well, that's very expensive.
Well, see, that was the wildest thing for me, because this was my first. So I'd recorded with Andrew Crawford before, and anybody who's recorded with Andrew, they kind of know what they're doing, because Andrew really builds a song instrument by instrument, and it's really cool how he does it, but it takes a little longer, and there's more of a process. And Andrew and his fiance Brandy Cole, they're doing really well. And so it got where it was harder and harder for us to line up schedules, myself included, because of my touring schedule too. And so when I called Brad, he's like, "We'll do it." He said, "We'll be able to do everything in a day, and you just come back and do vocals." And so, and I'm actually working with Ian Guthrie at 101. He's the one who's the main kind of driving force and producer behind my record. But the wildest thing was, I go in, it's like, hey, you know, this is your band for today. I'm like, okay, cool. You know, guys, do y'all want to hear the songs? They're like, oh, we sent it. We got everything charted out. They go in. I didn't tell them hardly anything I wanted. I mean, I gave them like little bits, and they just track a song in two takes. And it's the wildest thing in the world to see, because you hear about it and you hear about these musicians and you're like, okay, but this is, and then you sit there and you're like, what the hell? Like, I think we tracked four songs completely except for vocals in 5.5 hours.
Anyone else in your family musically inclined? Was there someone else you saw?
So I lost my grandfather at a young age. I was 10 when he passed, and he was, and him and all his brothers were. And that was the weird thing was, by the time that I even came to notice it, like before I was around, and I've been told so many stories, and they would get together and just sit there and play. And it might be bluegrass, it might be gospel, it might be country. They did all kinds of stuff. And all his brothers did it. And so but it skipped a generation.
Right.
Because, you know, my dad and my uncle don't play. And then my cousins, Daniel and Hannah, they don't play. Like, none of them play. And I just found it.
Yeah.
You know, I can vivid, you know, you're talking about Phil, you know, he had Phil's music. And they had Phil's music. I vividly remember, and I mean, God, I was so young, but I remember walking into that store one time and seeing stuff. Like, and I mean, I could kind of, like I said, but that's the only real memory I have of that, because I didn't start playing music till later.
Yeah.
And it was already gone by the time I got into music. And then, but I can remember, and I still have this guitar. It's in my baby brother's bedroom. But I remember coming home, and because I lived next door to him.
Yeah.
So I came home, I walked in, and he's holding a Cherry Sunburst Epiphone Les Paul. And I thought it was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
And I sat there, and so he was sitting there, and the first scale you teach kids is just doing the four, just doing the first four notes on the top of the, and just going down. And he sat there, and he told me, he's like, all right, he said, sit there and play that. Well, I was like, seven or eight. I like to pretend like I have a little more focus now.
I still
don't play scales.
Yeah,
but I remember that, and I remember when he passed. When he passed, I literally, my whole family was down at my great grandmother's house, and I walked up the hill, and I walked in the house, walked up there, and I just grabbed that guitar. I didn't like play it because I didn't know how to play it, but I just grabbed it, and I felt connected to him. And then the guitar that he had left me when he did pass was the guitar that I learned on, and it was a Washburn a 90. Okay, I know this. It's a 93 Washburn D14.
Yeah,
and I still have it. I'd never get rid of it, but I mean that's what I learned on, you know, and that's what I and you know, so he was really. There was nobody in my family other than him when I was super young. I was like into music. Right. Now everybody in my family listened to different music.
Right.
And that's what helped. And yeah. I think that's what did, cause I'm, you know, my uncle was a big into the late, you know, early to late 90s through early 2000s rock music and stuff like that. And then, you know, my grandmother was I'm a huge Elvis fan.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, I got exposed to Elvis, and my dad, he's a 50-year-old redneck, so I grew up with Waylon and Hank and Dave Allen Coe and all these guys. And my mom just listened to whatever was on the radio, right. And so with, like with all this, like the catalog of bands and musicians and stuff that I was exposed to, really kind of opened it up. And I always liked it.
Yeah,
like I did choir. I literally did choir from 4th grade to 11th grade.
Wow.
And the only reason I didn't do it in 12th grade is because I got accepted to the Fine Arts Center, and I went and studied under Eddie Howard for audio engineering.
Yeah.
And, but that was the only reason I didn't do it then. And, you know, that, and then I did musical theater. And so I knew that I wanted it, but it just took me more to kind of find it. I had to find it with other people. One of the big people that helped me out when I first got going and started doing it was Corey Stevenson.
Yeah.
Corey, he actually came to our show on Friday. Blake played in his band for like 2 years after we stopped playing together. And so Blake, you know, we talked about it. It's like Corey taught me a lot about venues and booking and stuff like that passively.
Yeah.
But him and Greg Payne from the Piedmont Boys both were very nice and way nicer to a 16-year-old, 17-year-old than they could have been.
Yeah.
And, you know, let me open shows and let me play during their breaks.
Yeah.
And just stuff like that. That really kind of helped progress.
That's
me.
So cool, man.
But yeah, so as far as like direct family, when I started, because I didn't start playing guitar till I was 14 or 15.
Right.
So as far as direct family, I didn't have anything like once I started.
Yeah.
But at a very young age, my grandfather was the first introduction to music.
You mentioned high school. You said Blue Ridge?
Yes, sir.
Were you a good student?
You know, to be honest, I really wasn't bad. I hear kids and like, I never really got in trouble, like in anything serious. I've never.
What about grades?
I graduated with a 3.3. Like,
okay.
Like, I mean, like,
I'm trying to find something to write this down. This is my 13th episode. you are the first person that I've interviewed, a musician, who said, I wasn't a bad student, and you mentioned 3.3. Everyone else said, are you a good student? No, I was not a good student. So yeah, and you're the exception to the rule. I knew there was one out there. Hey, I got a pen right here.
Well, and that was the thing. Like, well, and two, I had a mom who, like, yeah, you didn't get bad grades. I got, like, if you got bad grades, I got reprimanded hard.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories to tell that my mother denies that happened wholeheartedly, 100%, and there was no other reason. You know, you get report cards sent home.
Sure.
But then in the middle between report cards, they give you progress reports,
yeah,
which are awful. That's a terrible thing to do, because you're sitting there trying to explain to your mom, they haven't put half these grades in. They haven't, like, and they're like, I don't believe you. I'm like, call them.
Yeah.
This woman who's got 30, you know, because teachers are so overworked and so underappreciated.
Sure.
And these teachers were under so much, and that was when I was in school, not comparative to even what the craziness is now.
Yeah.
And, but, like, I got, like, I'm not even joking, it was like a 70 or a 72 or something. It's something in that range. My parents took my door off.
Oh, wow.
They took the door off my bedroom. So, and I hope that my parents listen to this episode, because I'm telling everybody that y'all did that. but yeah, and like, but for the most part, I mean, I was nowhere close to being in the running for valedictorian or anything like that. And half of what it was, because I was not a good math student. The only math that I'm good at is, like, money, like money and percentages.
That's one of the most important ones you need to be good
at. Outside of that, I was terrible at math and I was terrible at science. And I had science teachers who were very nice, and they cared, and they would try to explain it to me.
Yeah.
It just didn't work.
So what was the first band you ever played in?
So the first band I ever played in, my first two bands I ever played in, we never did anything. We were truly just in a basement of our parents' house. But the first thing I ever did was, I was like, freshman year is a terrible band name. It was a band called Simply Chaotic. And I think we played like two open mics at my uncle's church. My uncle used to go to the Edge. So they had like these like open mic coffee house things or whatever. And we did like a couple songs there, but it was never anything. And then, when I was in high school, I met a guy who I'm still friends with to this day. He's a bassist. His name's Evan Hamlin. He's in a band called Origami, mm-hmm, and a fantastic band. And cause he's an amazing bass player. And we were called Crownless Kings. And once again, we did nothing. And it was at that moment that I was like, I don't need to be in a band. I'm like, I'm just gonna put this under my name. And that was the thing too. All the bands that I was listening to, most of them were just songwriters.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, these guys don't have anybody to tell them they don't want to do this, or they don't want to do this song, or they don't want to do this song. So I'm like, I'm gonna do it. So I did. I've done the solo acoustic thing, pretty steadily since I was about 17. And then when I dropped out of college, I went and got a job, and then just started just hitting it as hard as I could. And it wasn't till last year, I came to Blake, and I came to one of my other best friend, JP, who's a bassist. And I was like, look, guys, I'm like, I think I can get us booked. I was like, I think that I've done this long enough and made enough connections to where I could get us booked. And they're like, well, what do we want to be called? And so American Aquarium got their name from a Wilco song.
Okay.
And the line, I can't think of the name of the song, but the line is like, I'm just a fish swimming around in a big American aquarium. And that's where he got it. So I was like, this band is one of my biggest influences. I'm like, I'm going to do one of their songs as my thing. And it kind of, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So I was going to call it Jarrett Forster and the PBR Promenade. Cause that was one of my favorite, songs by them. And, well, so I did that, and I did like one show or whatever under that, and like people kept going, well, what does this mean, and where, why'd you call? And I'm just like, you know what, guys, I was like, let me just go back through the albums, because I was like, I'm just gonna go back through the albums. I'm like, because I've made up my mind. And so I was scrolling, and I turned on the Wolves album, and I turned it on, and I hit it, and I just hit shuffle, and Southern Sadness came on. And I was like, and I was sitting there listening to this song going, yeah, because it talks, you know, it talks about, like, the first line of the song is, ever since the day I could talk, I cussed every street light in this town. And I'm just listening to it. And as much as I love my town, like I get, you know, and we're sitting there and I'm sitting there listening to it. I was like, this is it. And so I told the boys, I'm like, we're Jarrett Forster and the Southern Sadness. And like, cool. I mean, they don't care.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so our whole goal was, I was like, let's try to get like 10 shows this year. I was like, we can get 10 to 15. You know, so we'll do 10 to 15 shows. I'm like, then we'll try to do a little bit more next year. Cause they all work regular jobs.
Yeah.
So, and, I was like, let's just do this. Well, it took us about a month, 2 months. And I think we're going to end up playing like 30 or 35 this year because like venues that I play at, they're like, hey, you want to just do the band show? Well, hell yeah, dude, because I have so much more fun when I do the band show. And it's to the point now that it's almost like the people that come to my show, I have two separate fan bases.
Yeah.
I have a fan base of my solo acoustic show because it's very like 70s songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
That's that when I get to do the show that I want to do, because I love like Loggins and Messina and John Prine and these guys like that. And then when I do my full band show, it's like country southern rock show, and like we do everything.
Yeah,
like we were sitting there last night, or not last night, but it was last week, and the bar kind of died out. It hit like 1 o'clock, and I was like, hey, Blake, let's do that Creed song. And so like, we did My Sacrifice, and we started doing Three Doors Down. Like we just do what we want, and we're all friends. And we're all friends. We all listen to, you know, we all have a different taste of music, but we all listen to the same music as well.
Right.
So it's just like, hey, what do y'all want to do? Y'all want to do this song? Yeah, let's do this song.
Yeah.
And we just try it. And so I've loved this next chapter of my music career. And we actually, we're going to Illinois on Labor Day weekend. Because have you ever heard of the band Head East?
Yeah.
So we're opening for Head East.
Oh, man.
And
really?
Yeah. And here's the bad part. And I'll say this, and you can keep it or not, because I told the guy who booked me. I was like, the guy messaged me, asked me if I would open. I was like, yeah, we agreed on a number. We agreed on, you know, we agreed on everything. And he was like, you'll be opening for Head East. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And like, that was like, I was like, all right, yeah, whatever. And I was like, cool, great. I was like, we'll be there this time. And he's like, you know, load ins this time. Great. And I was like, I looked at Blake because he was like, oh, sweet, we're going to Illinois, because I got a good little following in like Southern Illinois.
Yeah.
And he's like, so who are we opening for? I was like, I have no idea. Hold on. And so we went. I said, I can't tell you a single song of these people.
Yeah.
And then when we looked them up, we was like, oh, okay. And then there was one that I didn't know their version. I knew the Rainbow version because we love Dio and Black Sabbath. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. This is great. And so we're super excited to open for those guys. But yeah, like it was just funny. Like I did everything but look up the band we were opening for.
I saw your calendar, man. You're traveling a good bit,
and that's what I love. I know there's a lot of people that stay in town and they do it for various reasons, whether it's family, whether it's, you know, stability, whatever. But I came to the conclusion a long time ago that as long as I stay here, only people here are going to know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started trying to travel. One day I was like, you know what, we're going to do this. And so I just started setting goals, and it was just, I want to do this. And I was like, I want to play here. So I did it. And that was the thing. And so like once a month I have a run that I do on the coast of South Carolina, and I do it's like Myrtle Beach. And then I go to
where do you play?
So weirdly enough, I only have one spot in Myrtle Beach now. Because a lot of my other spots kind of stopped doing the acoustic thing.
Yeah.
But I play at Bowie's in North Myrtle Beach.
Yeah.
It's right next to, it's like North Myrtle. So it's kind of like the older part of Myrtle Beach.
Oh yeah.
And so I play down there once a month. And then I play, in Charleston. There's two separate breweries. I play at Common Works Ale House and, Rusty Bull. Those are my two main spots down there. And then I play at, Woodward Tavern every month in Mount Pleasant. And then I play at a Siwi restaurant in Awanda.
Okay.
And that's a cool little restaurant with a lot of history in it.
Yeah.
And have you ever heard of Awanda Green?
Oh, yeah.
So it's right across the street. So I was playing. It was only like my second time playing there. And I'm sitting there playing there, and I'm playing, and I see a guy walk in. Like, people are walking in, and I'm not paying attention. But I see a guy walk in. I'm like, huh, he looks kind of familiar. Didn't think anything of it. Just went back to playing my show. Well, there was a guy sitting here, and he goes, hey, man. He's like, can you do any Hootie and the Blowfish? I'm like, yeah. So I play Let Her Cry or something. And then I see the guy get up, and he walks towards me. And he's walking towards me, and he goes, sounds great, man. Throws a 20 in my bucket and walks back. And I was like, that's Mark Bryan from Hootie and the Blowfish. I said, oh, hell. And I walked up, and I was like, dude, I feel like a dick. I was like, I'm not even going to lie. I was like, I would not have played that if you were standing here, because I know that, you know, he goes, and he was super nice. Yeah. And I mentioned to him, I'm like, hey, I was like, weird story. I was like, when I did pest control, and this is 100% true. So when I did pest control for 2.5 years, I did Edwin McCain's pest control.
Yeah.
And I met him twice. I mainly dealt with his wife or whatever, but I did his pest control. And I told this story on TikTok. He actually responded to it. But, and I was like, he goes, and I was, he was like, oh, that's cool, man. I was like, you know, so I was like, so, and I handed him one of my vinyls. I was like, so if you ever want to take another long haired kid from Greenville on tour, I'm available. And that was my exact line. And he goes, that's hilarious. And he took, yeah, but he was super nice. Yeah. And, but yeah. And so,
I'm trying to get him on the podcast.
Edwin?
Yeah. Yeah. He, I did, Tez was on.
Yeah.
Tez and I, we laughed uncontrollably for 2 hours. It was great. And they were just getting ready to go do Hootie Fest.
Yeah. And yeah. Down in
Cancun.
Like Cancun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm saying, I'm just like, and like, you know, Edwin gets to do some cool stuff. And being a songwriter from the area, you can't help but know him. You can't help but see. And then, like, you know, and Tez, I've known Tez because I used to show up to all the jams.
Yeah.
That was what when I first started, I was like, I'll just go to these jams. I'm like, I'm not going to play.
Tez is so generous with his, yeah, with his time and to other musicians.
And will give you the best, yes, advice. Like, he'll sit down and, like, because he told me, he's like, just stay focused. And that sounds like such a simple thing, but he goes, just stay focused. He said, you don't have kids. You're not married. He's like, really? You know, and when you think of some of the best drummers around here, you can't help but come up with him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he would be in my top two.
Yeah. I mean, because, like, I mean, you have him. You have, God, his name is Jonathan something. I don't know why his name is leaving me, but his name is Jonathan. Kariah Spelling.
Mm-hmm.
She was my drummer for about 6 months, and then she had to take a step back just because of work stuff. And then now my drummer now is Cody Schroeder, who was with 3 and 20 for years, and who, yep, was also the drummer for Smoking Guns.
Yep.
And, you know, we are extremely fortunate to have some amazing drummers in our area. And, you know, it's just, and you have so many different drummers, like, and that's the thing, like, the drummer for the band Reviler, the hardcore bands around here, is who's been tattooing me.
Yeah.
You know, and we sit there and started talking about that, and I mean, it's wild, the amount of musical talent that's around here is crazy. But yeah, back to the traveling. So I was like, I need to be gone.
Yeah.
I need to be gone. And so I started talking to people who toured.
Yeah.
And that's how I met two of my extremely close friends, Chance Stanley, who I mentioned that I, mm-hmm, that I wrote a song for the upcoming singles that are coming out with, and Pistol Hill. And I had this, I'd hatched this plan. I used to do booking for this barbecue restaurant. And so what I would do is, there were bands that, like, maybe I didn't know, but I really liked, because I love local music from the independent music. So it was Pistol Hill, and I was like, I don't know you, but I want to know you.
Yeah.
And so I knew that we were, like, friends on Facebook. And then another one was Jack Marion. Mm-hmm. And it's Jack Marion of the Pearl Snap Prophets. And so, like, I booked them at that restaurant just so I could meet
them. Just so you could hear.
Just so I could meet it. And so when I met Pistol and I met Chance, I was like, these are my people.
Yeah.
These guys get it. And so we met that night. I played with them that night. We started talking. I was like, hey, guys. I'm like, look. I'm like, can we put something together? I'm like, I don't really care about the money. I was like, because they would travel a lot together.
Yeah.
And I was like, if y'all add me in, they're like, all right, dude, you know what? They're like, we got this run to Illinois. The places we're going, They love us there. I think they'll love you, you know. And so they took me, and we did like Wednesday at the Buccaneers Club, and we did Thursday somewhere else. And we did Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then we drove back.
How many dates are you playing? Both solo and band.
Solo band with people. I think I'm somewhere in the 215, 220 mark.
Yeah.
This will be my biggest year. This will be the third year in a row I've went over 200.
Yeah.
I'll be 100% honest. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I would love.
I would love to get paid a shit ton of money to do 10 shows a year.
Well, I'm not on that spectrum either. I think the perfect number is 150. If I could do 150 a year, that would be perfect.
I mean, talking 3 days a week.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. Well, and that's the thing too. Like, because I see people that do it, but like, I would love to do like 3 months on, a month off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll do 3 months straight of six shows a night or six shows a week.
Sometimes it's hard to turn. Certain gigs are hard to turn down.
Oh God.
Cause you know, they're going to be great just because of where they are and who it is.
And that was the thing. And so we went, and I mean, the money on that run wasn't anything close to bad or anything. It was fair, and we all split it, but we had such a great time.
Yeah.
And I was like, and it was one of those things where like, this is what the Highwaymen felt like.
Yeah.
Not exactly. I mean, we were playing bars.
Yeah.
But we sat there every night, and we were in Illinois. So, you know, weed's legal up there. So like, and we got a super cheap motel so we could smoke in there. And so we'd sit there and we'd smoke and we'd hang out and we just talk and just tell jokes and stuff. I'm like, this is great.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is what I want to do. And Pistol, who he's not really playing much anymore. He told me, he gave me a great piece of advice about touring. He goes, you know, no matter how bad the show is, no matter what, he goes, because you're going to get the same amount of money you're going to get somewhere else. He said, you know that when you're on the road, if that show in that town sucked, tomorrow you're in a different town.
Yeah.
He said, you play a bad show at your hometown. He said, you wake up there again.
Yeah.
He said, you play a show 9 hours away. He said, in the morning you wake up, start driving. He said, you're 3 hours away from that bad show. And I was like, yeah. And I go on the road, and there's shows that I know, like when I book them, I'm like, God, this is going to be terrible. But it's $150 on a Monday, you know, like, and there's stuff you do, but it, you know, I just love to travel. I love seeing stuff. And I mean, like I get to see a lot of what I call forgotten towns.
Yeah.
Because like, I'm not playing when I go to Illinois, I'm not playing Chicago. I'm playing Johnston City, which is a great town. It's a cool little town, but nobody's like going there. Or like when you get out of Kentucky, when you head to Southern Illinois, once you get there, you're right when you cross the line, you take that exit and you go to Metropolis, Illinois. And if you've never been to Metropolis, it's a cool little town because it's Superman's hometown. I'm not joking. So this whole little town, and it's about the size of Greer.
Yeah.
Like it's about the size of downtown Greer. But this whole little town is themed like Superman.
Oh, wow.
Right in front of town hall, it's got to be at least 30 feet tall. It is a 30-foot tall statue of Superman. And they have a Superman museum. And it's like nobody's going to like seek out to find that.
Yeah.
But you just find it.
It'd be like a kid in the candy store.
You just find, like, I will stop at every roadside museum and like stuff like the world's largest rocking chair or the world's largest ball of paint.
Yeah.
Stuff that's for people like me. That's for people like me. Like, because so I got like, we went, when we were on the road with Billy Don Burns, we did a week with Billy Don Burns. And it was one of the coolest things ever. We were driving through, and we were leaving North Florida, driving to Prattville, Alabama. And we were driving, and I just see a sign, and it says, "Home of Hank Williams Sr." And I looked at JP, who was with me for that week. I said, "You want to go?" He goes, hell yeah, I want to go. And so we went and saw the childhood home of Hank Sr. And we paid $10 and I don't know who this woman is, but this woman knew everything there was to know about Hank Williams. And she just sits there. You walk in. She said, it's $5. Take the tour, sweetie. Well, you hand her $5 in cash, and you walk around this house. And you stand in that room, which I believe was the living room at the time.
Yeah.
And she's just sitting in a rocking chair telling you stuff. And we sat there for 45 minutes listening to this woman tell us about Hank Sr. And she was telling us about this. And, well, he did this with this woman. And I'm just like, this is the wildest thing ever. We never would have found that.
Had you not just been driving?
Had we not just been driving?
In the middle of nowhere.
And that's the coolest part to me is, yeah, I look at a lot of parking lots and I look at a lot of gas stations. But in between, I get to see a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah. And people don't realize that, if you made it famous and you're on a tour bus, you don't have that same experience.
Yeah, you don't see it.
You know, you're resting between shows and you're traveling, 500 miles, 1,000 miles. Somebody else is driving. You're trying to get some sleep because you got a show to do that night, that kind of thing. So, sometimes it's pretty cool to just be driving yourself, two or three guys in a car, sharing the experience together and seeing some cool shit.
Well, and that's the wild thing too is if you've seen my social media, one of the things that has become synonymous with me is my tiny red camper. So I have this little teardrop camper that's built. It was built on a 4x8 trailer.
Yeah.
And it's basically just like a rolling bed and it's not that comfortable. There's no AC in it. Like I have like a fan. I've found ways to cool it down, but it's got power to it. And I sleep in parking lots.
Mm.
But, I've slept in a parking lot where I could literally hear the ocean. Mm. And I open that door when I get out in the morning. I just smell salt air. Or, I go and, I meet people. And, it's become part of my thing.
Yeah.
And so, and because I travel alone, because I'd say about 95% of my touring is by myself.
Yeah.
As far as actual touring. And that's the thing. I stop everywhere. I'm a huge food person.
Yeah.
Every time I go through Alabama, I stop at Milo's. Every time I'm in Florida, I go to Whataburger.
Yeah. You've got Jared Forrester Music on Facebook.
Jared Forrester Music is kind of just across the board.
Yeah.
Facebook and Instagram. And then it's just Jared Forrester on all the streaming sites.
Do you have a website?
I do not.
Okay.
I don't have a website, but everything's all there. And as far as communicating with me, I'm the only person on any of those sites. So if you message that Instagram, if you message that Facebook, whatever, you're getting me, So take that with what you will,
Do you use a booking agent?
I don't. Mm-hmm. Well, not for... I'd say about 99%. I have a woman who's got me a handful of stuff in the coastal area.
Right.
Because on the coast, especially Myrtle Beach area, everybody, all these bars don't want to book.
Right.
So you have to just be tied in. But pretty much, I would say, if I'm going to do 220 shows this year, I'd say I booked myself at least 205 to 210.
Yeah. Now, how far have you traveled?
I've went all the way to top part of Indiana for a show before. Mainly my farthest traveling is mainly southern Illinois to northern to central Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I have a really good friend out in Oklahoma. So next year we're working on doing a big out to Oklahoma and back kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, so I've done, let's see. 3 hours is 200 miles. 3 hours is 200 miles. Illinois is 9 hours away. So, is that 600 miles?
Yeah.
So, anywhere from 600-700 miles. I'm going to Ohio for the first time this month.
Oh, wow.
Me and Chance Stanley are opening for Chris Knight.
Okay.
And so I get to go to Ohio for the first time. But, yeah, so Illinois is about as far Midwest as I've went. And then Florida, northern Florida is about as far south as I've went.
Up till what you're getting ready to finish, how many songs have you recorded and released?
Oh, that's a great question. So I did five on the first EP that we don't talk about that much. then I did eight songs, so that's 13. for the albums. That was 8, and then we did 5 more, so that's 18. Then we had a single last year, so that's 19. So, and then we got 5 more this year, so we got like 24.
So the 5 that are coming out, it's going to be a new EP, or are you just going to do 5 singles?
So what so I keep going back and forth. I know that no matter what, these 5 songs are going to come out as singles every 8 weeks.
Yeah.
So we're just going to pump them out release one every 8 weeks. I've talked to Ian. I've talked to the band because I had a single last year, and then we got 5 new singles this year. And I was like, if I just go in and pay to record 2 or 3 more songs, I can just release it as an album.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
What I'm either going to do is do, 2 more or do like 5 or 6 more. I haven't made up my mind yet. But as of right now, they're just 5 singles. And I wrote 2 of them myself.
Mm-hmm.
One of them I wrote with Chance Stanley. And then one of them is a Will Hoag song that he gave me permission to cut. And then the other one is a Ward Davis song that he gave me permission to cut when I opened for him back in January.
Yeah.
So
what's the next – the first song of these 5 that's going to be released?
So we haven't picked yet.
Oh, okay.
That's the – and I keep saying we. It's just me.
Yeah.
I haven't made up my mind yet.
But I know you seek out advice.
Yeah.
From your friends and people.
Yeah, I'm like, hey, what do y'all think? And what we're thinking is we're thinking about releasing the one that Will wrote first because – So we do the final. We're doing the final mix tomorrow. So mastering should be done in like 2 weeks. So I'm hoping to have everything by the end of the month. So I'm thinking about, like I said earlier, we're opening for Head East in Illinois, and it's on September 1st, and it's on a Friday. So we're thinking about putting that song out that day.
Yeah.
But I haven't 100% made up my mind. I think we're going to do the song that Will wrote. It's called "Times Are Not Changing."
Okay.
This is my first time ever doing any kind of song that reflects any sort of political views of mine.
Right.
And it's not really as more of a political song as it is a social song.
Right.
Because the entire song is talking about how the elites in this country are tearing it apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about how there are people that can help that won't, and they don't realize where they came from. They don't realize, and it talks about the same. The beginning of the song talks about the hippie in 1964 who was protesting wars is the same guy that loved Reaganomics and benefited from it and passed down generational wealth to where his family didn't know what it was like to be here.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I don't care how much money you have. That doesn't matter to me, and how you got it. I don't care. But what does bother me is if you can help people and you don't.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what's the basis of this song. It's a,
well, I talk about being good stewards of the community.
Yeah.
And even if you're not helping with your money, you're helping with your knowledge and with your time. And there's so many ways to help. And I always thought if I won the lottery, there was so much that I could do to help people. And I've always dreamed of that. And I would say, I would go help people. I would try to do that.
There are 2 charities that are so near to my heart that if I could just write huge checks to, I would.
Sure.
One of them is Guitars for Vets.
Yeah.
And it is exactly what it sounds like. They are helping veterans who come back with PTSD. You know, my mother's a veteran. My aunt's a veteran. Like, they come back with PTSD, and each veteran, I want to say, gets – I could be wrong, but I know they get – I think it's like 8 guitar lessons for free and get a free guitar.
Yeah.
You know. And so – but the other one that's even – closer to me, and it's because I'm involved with the organization, is the Shriners Hospital for Children. So I've been a Shriner since I was 19 years old.
My dad was a hospital guy.
Yeah.
And that was one of the most rewarding things that he ever did. And I was in a band when I was 15 or 16 years old, and we played at the Shriners, the old Shriners Hospital.
So when I first started, I played Greenville Shrine Club.
Oh, wow.
So I sat there and choked on smoke in the Greenville Shrine Club playing to those old men.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, we played at the hospital for the kids that were there, and we were nobody. We were just playing around some of these little clubs and stuff around here. My dad was a guide. Go ahead.
No. I'm just looking.
And so these kids were so extremely happy to see us. They treated us like rock stars. I mean, they were just the smiles and the, you know, and you walk out of there thinking, nobody deserves this, and especially children don't deserve this.
It's the wildest thing.
It breaks your heart. You're so glad you were able to do it. It's so emotional. And then you think, and it affected me. I was 14, 15 years old. It affected me for the rest of my life. I'll never forget that.
So I remember, and I remember trying to tell people, because, you know, being a Shriner, you have to be an ancient Freemason, and mm-hmm. there's all kinds of stuff that people say off of it. But I'm not even going to get into that, but you get asked a lot, why would you want to do it? And a lot of us, you know, you hear, why would you want to be a Shriner? Why would you want to do this? And a lot of us have the same, well, my grandpa was one, my dad was one, my uncle was one, whatever. And that's the foothold to get you into it. But then you get into it and you're like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
One of the things that I find the video every time I'm talking to somebody about it is I'm like, when you see a child, and you, this 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old child, and you see them sitting in a wheelchair, and you see them sit there and push themselves up, and not only walk, but run down a hallway, and they have nothing but the biggest smile on their face of something that we take advantage of every day. My fat ass isn't running, you know, but like you see that child live that, and it's like, you can't help but want to do it.
Yeah.
You can't help but want to help. And so that's what I was going to talk about. You were talking about playing at the hospital. It's not the hospital. It's going to be at the Greenville Shrine Club. I know that I'm involved with it. I believe James Radford's involved with it. There's a couple, the Cashmere Possums, I know, are there.
Yeah.
There's about 10 bands playing throughout the whole day, and it's called Fezzapalooza.
Okay.
And it's August 12th. It's going to be at the Greenville Shrine Club. You can find all the information if you look up Greenville Shrine Club or Fezzapalooza about tickets, because I don't know anything about that. I'm just showing up with a guitar.
We'll find it.
I'll post links on
the page and,
there's
and,
so
and the
much,
podcast information.
There's
will be
so
there.
Much local talent that's going to be there, and all this money goes back to these kids.
Yeah.
It all goes back to the hospital. Sorry for my little tangent on the Shriners Hospital, but it's an extremely important cause, and I think that more people need to know about it.
So I got to ask about the book. Did you publish the book?
Yes,
sir.
What is next? So,
where can we get the book?
Amazon. Amazon and barnesandnoble.com, and then I have copies at every show. It's called Strum Can't Drum. I published it back last August.
Yeah.
Basically, I got bored on tour one night. And I was sitting in the camper, and I was like, I'm going to write a children's book. It's called Strum Can't Drum. And basically, it's about an acoustic guitar who wants to make music but doesn't know how. And he wants to – and so this whole thing is his journey into finding his own sound. So he goes, and he goes to his friend Megan Microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And Megan Microphone is trying to show him how to sing. He can't sing. He goes to Donnie Drum, but he says he hates the way that the sticks feel when they hit him.
Right.
He goes to Patty Piano. He finally gets to Betty Bass, and Betty Bass says, "Why are you trying to sound like all this stuff? So why don't you sound like you?" And she says, "I'm going to introduce you to somebody." And so she introduces Strum to Peter Pick, and Peter Pick says, "I know what to do." And so he gets up and he starts strumming. You know, he starts plucking the strings, and Strum's like, "I didn't know that I could sound like this." And at the end of it, the end of the book, you know, spoiler alert to this 15-page book, but the end of the book is all of them get together and they jam and they play music. And the whole point of the book is it's okay to be you.
Yeah.
It's okay to be different.
Yeah.
Because there's a purpose. There's a purpose for you.
Yeah.
It might not be this. You know, my younger brother is 18 years old. He just graduated. He's working at my dad's pest control company. He's also working at SCW Eurodrive. Mm-hmm. I could never do what he's doing. I can do the pest control side because I did it. I just didn't like it.
Yeah.
I liked sales. I didn't like the labor part of it.
Yeah.
My brother can look at something, take it apart, put it back together. He has a purpose.
Yeah.
And that's his. My purpose is to entertain drunk people. It's just what it is. But yeah, and so So I did everything. I wrote the book. I wrote the book. I illustrated the book with Canva. Went through, got everything done. My friend, who is also a children's book author, Nikisha Shannon, she helped me size everything right, and published it through Amazon. And it's like I said, it's on Amazon. I got to go to a couple schools and read these.
Wow.
It was really cool because like these schools were like, yeah, you can come read. I'm like, oh, okay. And they asked me to teach these kids a song, and like, I mean, you don't realize how many songs you sing about like honky tonking and drugs and stuff until you're looking at a bunch of first graders.
Yeah.
But so I was like, who can I trust that has? I was like, John Prine.
Yeah.
Because John Prine says some nasty stuff. He just did it in a whimsical way.
Yeah.
And so I started going through his catalog. And so we landed on Paradise. And I'm like, cool. So I taught a bunch of first graders Paradise by John Prine, and I have a video, and I'll send it to you. But one of the schools that I went to was in Columbia, and the teacher is a musician that I know down there, and he's like, tell me whatever song. He's like, I'll get the kids to kind of know it before we start. And so I have a video of me sitting in a classroom singing, and these kids are singing every word to this John Prine song, and it's the coolest thing ever. But yeah, that was like a little, you know, how you were talking about like, do I want to do this when I'm 50? Do I want to, what's next? What? And I get like that because I've done theater, I've performed for so long, I've published a book, I always want to do just something else.
How many songs have you written?
Good songs?
Just songs in general.
No, I mean, realistically, because I'm not, like I was saying earlier, I'm not the kind of writer who's going to write a song every day.
Right, right.
I'm the kind of, like, and my process is very off the wall, but I just have notes in my phone, and it's just sometimes it's like, it hits, you know, and it's just like, but, I mean, I'd say in the realm of 35, 40 since I was about 16.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in that realm, and then, you know, I'm still trying to write and just progress more and just co-write with people. But yeah, in the 30, I'd say in the 35 to 40 is probably a safe bet.
Well, with over 200 shows a year, you're pretty much a road warrior.
Yeah.
And you're on the time. So you're a songwriter, singer, actor, author. What is something about you that people don't know? You have an odd habit. Do you collect things? Do you?
I do collect things. So do you know what Funko Pops are?
Yes.
Okay. So in my house right now, there is probably close to 200 Funko Pops. I've been collecting Funko Pops since it was the first girl I ever really dated. I dated her for almost. Almost 3 years. I remember this so vividly, but her name was Danielle, and she was into Funko Pops. And I was like, these are the stupidest things. I was like, why the hell are you doing this? Then I see it clear as day. I walked into Second Charles in Greenville.
Yeah.
Cause she wanted to go look for one. And it was really before what I kind of imagined the Funko boom was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause this was probably 2014.
Yeah.
And so we walked in, and I looked, and on the shelf was an entire set of Rocky Horror Picture Show Funko Pops. And I'm a huge Rocky Horror Picture Show fan. A dream of mine would be to lose enough weight to play Frankenfurter in a shadow cast and come out there like full fishnets. Oh, I'd do it too. I used to go to Secret Circus in Greenville and go see it, but because I'd love to play that role. But the thing is, and I was like, oh, that's cool as shit. So I bought like two or three of them, and then I went and I got and I had the whole set, and that was the first full set that I had. And so now kind of what I do is I have those, and I still buy from time to time, but I'm about to kind of start selling a couple.
Man, thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I've had the greatest time.
This has been great. I'd never met you. We had talked on Facebook. We've been friends on Facebook. I've been following you, and it's been such a pleasure having you here,
well,
man.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And if I can just kind of say this to wrap it up, because I don't feel like I've said half the things about any of my actual job. I've told you what kind of movies I like, but like I said, you can find me on Spotify and Instagram and Apple Music, anywhere you stream music. Please follow me on Spotify. We're going to be releasing 5 new singles, I believe, starting in September. We're going to put one out every 6 to 8 weeks. They're all kind of a little different. They were all produced by Ian Guthrie at Studio 101. I also have 3 amazing local sponsors who I just want to say thank you to.
Yeah.
Paper Street Sign Company in Spartanburg. Jeremiah over there does amazing work. So please send him business. He does all kinds of graphics and these huge signs and, I mean, just everything. He's such a good dude. And then we actually have an awesome apparel sponsor. It's What the Fin. Carrie from What the Fin. I met him at a concert and we just hit it off. Yeah. And it turned out I actually knew his daughter because I sat there and we sat there and talked, and we talked about endorsements and all that stuff. And he said, I'm gonna be honest with you. He's like, right now, budgeting, it doesn't really make sense for me. But come by. He said, what size do you wear? I was like, I wear an XL. He goes, all right, come by the shop. So I drive to the shop and he wasn't there. But the woman goes, are you Jarrett? And I was like, yes, ma'am. And she's like, here. And this man gave me so many What the Fin T-shirts and hats and stuff. So he's been great. And then Cowboy Custom Printing. I'm endorsed by them. They do all my merchandise. They do a lot of the bands in the Upstate's merchandise. They really will take care of you. So, like I said, they do screen printing, leather patch hats, koozies, buttons, whatever you need. If they can't do it, they'll find somebody who can. And they have been a great company to work for. But I just wanted to kind of put all that out so you could tag it at the end so people could go, who the hell is this guy? Well, this is that. But yeah, everything is either Jarrett Forster Music or Jarrett Forster. And I hope, like I said, I play anywhere from 5 to 7 shows a week. So I really hope to see some of you guys out there.
Thanks again, man.
Thank you so much.
Backstage with Chris Lee is a production of MB Media, copyright 2023. Be sure to like, follow, and share our posts on social media. You can download Backstage with Chris Lee wherever you get your podcasts.